Welcome to Coffee with Catholic Workers, a podcast made by and for Catholic workers. I'm Theo.
And I'm Lydia. We've both been part of the Catholic Worker for the last decade and are excited to bring you conversations with Catholic workers from around the world.
Today we have with us Michelle Narr Obed from Hildegard House, where she lived with her spouse Greg and several asylum seekers. Our discussion today covered a lot of ground, from plowshares actions to Kurdistan to oil pipelines.
We'll put a couple links in the show notes for some context of some of the things referenced for anybody who wants to learn a little bit more about them for context. But now, here's Michelle.
Well, welcome, Michelle. So grateful that you could join us this evening. Usually we start these off with kind of how did you find your way to the Catholic Worker movement, through the movement, to where you are today in the Catholic Worker movement?
Okay, so should I give a response at this point?
Yeah, what if you're willing.
Okay, well, thank you for asking me to be part of this. I've listened to some of the others and have really appreciated getting to know people a little bit better than like many of the people I've known for quite some time, but there are things that they shared on this that I didn't know. And so it's been very interesting. I found my way to the Catholic Worker via Jonah House. That's where I kind of started with all of this. And, Phil and Liz, they made it pretty clear that Jonah House was not a Catholic Worker, although it was hard for me to understand the differences, what distinguished it from the Catholic Worker. And there were many things that we did in Jonah House that were very much in keeping with the principles of the Catholic Worker, but I don't think I really understood what those principles were. And I really, until very recently, don't think I've understood what the principles of the Catholic Worker are. So anyhow, I spent 10 years at Jonah House, but probably 5 of those years were in and out of jail and prison and waiting to go to jail and prison. And while I was waiting, I spent time, my family and I, Greg and Rachel, spent time at the Norfolk Catholic Worker with Kim and Steve, I never really felt like that was my community. I always felt like I was there kind of like waiting for whatever was going to happen with the court system and the jail sentence. We lived with them and we helped with many of the things that they did, the breakfast line and the hospitality house, things like that. It still wasn't really part of my internalized like understanding of community. So anyhow, I spent two and a half years in prison. And then went back to Jonah House, and as part of the conditions of my release, I was not allowed to go back to Jonah House. And although I did, I violated that condition. And but before I violated that condition, after my release from the first round in federal prison, we went to. We came here to Duluth and lived at Loaves and Fishes because it was the only community that the probation officer would allow me to go to. I had applied to other Catholic workers through the probation department, and none of them were acceptable to the probation department. But for some reason, this one here in Duluth was acceptable, and I transferred and came out here. All of us came out here, and again, didn't really feel like that was my community. It was just kind of like trying to figure out what our next moves would be. And 10 months later, we went back to Jonah House, and then I went back to prison. for going home. And so after that last round of prison, we went back to Jonah House. I had no more probation hanging over me. And after about a year, we decided that maybe it would be good to go back to Duluth, to Loaves and Fishes, to the Catholic Worker, and really kind of embrace it as our community. And so we did. We did that. And I think there were so many things that I didn't really understand, particularly, like I said, about the principles of the Catholic Worker. I could explain to people like what the Catholic Worker wasn't, but I really couldn't explain to people what the Catholic Worker was. And when we came to Duluth, we were in a great transition. The community was in a great transition. So there were some traditional Catholic workers that were here and then had moved on. And then there was a group of young people that came, and they really were into the kind of like the anarchism movement. And they were putting that anarchism together with the Catholic Worker. But it was, I think because we, as the Greg and I, at that point now, we're the kind of the elders of this Catholic Worker. I think we were still struggling with trying to understand our, like, where our roots were. And so we had a hard time with that transition into these young anarchists coming in, who I think were struggling to understand, and at the same time were reinventing the wheel. And it was very tense. And then there were the kind of the older Catholic workers that had lived in the community, moved on, but still stayed on the fringes, were really upset with how that whole time was going. They felt like these young people had ruined their community and taken over their houses, and were, and we couldn't control them. Things kind of changed, and they changed. There's a group of them that came back to Loaves and Fishes, and they turned it into a nonprofit. And they kind of took the traditional route of like doing hospitality in the form of like extension of the shelter system. And there were many things about that I really I was willing to accept it, but it didn't seem right to me. And so shortly after that all happened, Greg was in prison. He had done a Plowshare Action, and that certainly was not part of their nonprofit image. So there were many things that we just did not fit any longer. So I and another long-term older member of Loaves and Fishes who had moved on started a new house called Hildegard House, and that's where we are now. So the long story short here is that we went through many, many learning processes, which I think to some extent we're still in, but I have now landed pretty clearly that the principles on which we're founded are the works of mercy and the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. How we live that out varies. It differs from generation to generation. We have no business kind of telling the next generation what they should do, how they should do it. But what we do want to be able to do is kind of carry on and keep people grounded in those basic principles. And are those principles out of the Roman Catholic Church? No. These principles predated the Roman Catholic Church. These were the early Christians and Jesus's teachings. And the Roman Catholic Church came out of Constantine in the 3rd century. So I'm sure they have been altered to some extent to kind of fit the when the Roman Catholic Church sold out and became the Roman Catholic Church, I'm sure that some of these teachings that they carried on in the Gospels, that they you know, gave to us in the Gospels, were altered when, you know, they've changed many of the books, you know, burned information, passed. It's been translated many, many times. So I'm sure that in the translation, it's somewhat different than what Jesus and the early disciples and the early Christian communities were actually doing. But if you kind of like look at the whole picture and not little bits and pieces, you see that the Beatitudes and the works of mercy all kind of like fit in with all the way going back to the Old Testament. And they also fit in, they're universal. When you listen to the other great faith traditions, you hear the same things about how to live with each other in creation and the world and with the Creator. So I kind of feel like they have like kept the test of time and kept true to the test of time. And so how we live them out again is going to change based on what we are facing. And our world right now is run amok with craziness. And I know that the younger people are facing things that our generation did not face. So yeah, that's basically how we got here.
Wow. So Michelle, there's so much going on in the world and all of these issues. What are the ways that you currently are living out these works of mercy, the Beatitudes, the principles from the Sermon on the Mount? What does that look like for you and for Hildegard House in these moments?
Yeah. So first, everything that we do in discernment with the Spirit and with other folks that we have developed deep relationships with, particularly with the Benedictine sisters up at St. Scholastica. And so they actually have changed from the time we started the Hildegard House. At first, we were looking at providing hospitality for women who were trying to get out of trafficking and needing a safe place to be, safe place, a welcoming place to heal, working in conjunction with other people that had more kind of the skills to deal with some of the things that they had dealt with, the traumas that they had dealt with. And there was a group up here that was forming that was working specifically on different issues related to sex trafficking. And our role was to just provide the hospitality. They very much wanted us to be part of their nonprofit system, and all of our supporters, many of our supporters wanted us to be part of the nonprofit system. And I knew it wasn't right. And so I kind of stood my ground on that no, we were not going to become a nonprofit. There were many things that we did in providing our hospitality. That was the best thing that was the best decision that we could have ever made, was to stay out of the nonprofit sector. But we also couldn't deal with many of the issues that the women were dealing with, and that nonprofit group fell apart. And when they first started, they told us, we got 5 years to get the grants, to get our acts together, to get our programs together, because after 5 years, if you don't have it together, then they're just going to go to the next hot issue, and the money that will dry up. And so that's the pressure that they were living under. And they were very surprised when we developed a house that could provide hospitality for three women right off the bat. Like they were just really they couldn't believe that we had done that. But because everything that they were doing was within the nonprofit, they had to fit in these tiny boxes. They couldn't do it. And they actually fell apart. When they fell apart, we realized that the hospitality that we were providing was not safe for anyone. It wasn't safe for them. It wasn't safe for us. It wasn't safe for our neighbors. I mean, it was really like we were beyond what we could handle. So we ended up moving away from that and in transition, again, thinking, is Hildegard House meant to close? What do we do? And so, you know, we went into lots of discernment, particularly with this some of the sisters, and they helped us kind of move and listen to where the spirit was taking us. Greg was out of prison at this point. We stayed active within the Catholic worker movement, which I think when we first moved to Loaves and Fishes, I didn't even understand really the whole movement issue. Like what it, like to be a Catholic worker meant that you had to be connected to a specific house. If you were not connected to that house any longer, you were not a Catholic worker. This did not make sense to me. And so like the whole, like the idea of being part of the movement and figuring out what it means to be a Catholic worker was more than being associated with a particular house and a particular function. So I think at the next kind of big phase that we entered into was we recognizing the works of mercy. When I was sick, you cared for me. And so who was very sick at the time? Our Mother Earth, quite sick. We were making her sick. And so caring for her meant to be in solidarity with her, to do what we could to help heal her, to stand against the forces that were aiding in her destruction. And so we came up with the valve turning action, where we turned off the oil from the Enbridge pipeline that was running through, that continues to run through northern Minnesota from Canada down to Superior, Wisconsin, where then it's refined and sent out to the market for sale. And not for us, but for the global market. So we were just basically a conduit. And in the process of doing that, I learned a lot from our indigenous neighbors. And I learned that this was not, this being part of this was not like a Catholic worker action where you did it in your own Catholic worker bubble, but that we were part of something that was not led by us and that was bigger than us, and that we really needed to listen to the wisdom of how our indigenous neighbors lived out their connection with the earth, and they were willing to teach us this, and these were great lessons. And to be part of that whole kind of campaign beyond the valve turning action, but it was the valve turning action that kind of led into the campaign against the pipeline that eventually was, it has been built and has done so much damage. It's still ongoing, and that's still part of what it looks like for us. In addition, we're doing hospitality for people who have been exploited through the immigration system. People who have fled from their countries because their lives were at risk, because their human rights were at risk, because, you know, lots of different reasons. And they have just been kind of like swept up and put in these detention centers where they're private detention centers that make $700 and something per day per person. And actually what they of tax money and actually what they put out per person is more like $5 a day. So they're making up quite a big profit off of making sure that these folks stay detained. And we've learned from some friends that there are people that the only reason they're in detention is because they don't have a sponsor. And so we started to look into that, and we're now sponsoring, we're part of a bigger network, which is another great thing, I think. Maybe I'll just tell that story. Hildegard House is part of the Interfaith Committee for Migrant Justice. And in Duluth, Superior, that looks like 20, 30 different congregations, the Islamic Center, the Buddhist Center, the Temple Israel, are all part of this. And they started out mostly as doing advocacy, education, consciousness awareness. And then when Hildegard House entered the scene, we thought, why not do hospitality? Why not do hands-on, becoming sponsors and having them live with us and having them live in our community instead of just being advocates? And so lots of people weren't really familiar with that, how to do that. So this is one of the works of mercy, welcoming the stranger. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. And so we made friends with some folks on the border who had been visitors at the detention centers and knew people that needed a sponsor. And so we got on this list of being potential sponsors. And Hildegard House, we started it off and we started taking people in, and other folks in other congregations, they saw, wow, maybe we can do that. And so one at a time, we have now 6 different families in Duluth housing 12 different asylum seekers. One at a time, they started to develop a Christ room. So this is like Peter Morin, right? If every parish had a Christ room, well, we wouldn't have, well, you know, this one, we wouldn't have homelessness. Well, they still had homelessness. And, you know, if every parish developed a Christ room and took in an asylum seeker, we'd still have a lot of asylum seekers in detention. But it was Peter's vision right there. Like, we're part of this kind of network of people who have developed Christ rooms in their houses and are taking people in. And without even knowing it, they're part of the Catholic worker movement. So that's how it's kind of shaping up for us here. And I don't know how long that will last. It'll last until the Spirit tells us it's time to move on to something else. I don't think it will be outside of Duluth, because part of our commitment here is a commitment to stability. And I mean, at one point I think early on when we first stopped doing the trafficking hospitality, I thought, well, maybe we're just not meant to live here in Duluth. Maybe Duluth doesn't really want a Catholic worker. Maybe they want another nonprofit. And so that was the question in my mind. Does Duluth want a Catholic worker, or do they want another nonprofit? Because we are ripe up here with nonprofits. Like, they are all over the place. So we tried to test out, like, what, and that's when I started to really intentionally verbalize what it means to be, to follow the works of mercy, what it means to be a Catholic worker, what those principles are. It wasn't defined in the specific work, but in the principles. And that's when it became more clear to me. And then it became clear that this is something that Duluth does want, because they don't seem to be wanting us to leave. So, and the Spirit doesn't seem to be moving us out of here either. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Like, you're a secret evangelical Catholic worker converting people into the movement without them even knowing. But it really is, like, right? Isn't that like the whole piece of the movement of how do we get it so it's something that not just small groups of people are doing, but that it really is a cultural shift, or a widespread shift, going from viewing our property as our own to this idea of, like, no, it's not meant for us to keep to ourselves, but to share with others.
Right.
I'm curious, you brought up earlier, you know, you were talking about Jonah House, you mentioned going to prison, you mentioned Greg going to prison, you used the word plowshares. I don't think that any of those are words that have come up yet on the podcast. And while many folks who are friends with the Catholic worker movement or fans of the Catholic worker movement are probably aware of them. I was wondering if you could kind of introduce those things to folks who might not be aware of them. And then even for me, who's been around the movement for like a dozen years or so, I've heard that line that you used earlier, that like Jonah House was not a Catholic worker, though we're obviously good friends. I wonder if you could like talk a little bit about what you see is different in the thought of Jonah House, and what you think is kind of the heart of the Catholic worker as well. You said that that's been like a years long journey figuring that out. So I don't know, I just threw a whole lot of questions at you there.
Yeah. Okay. So Jonah House itself was kind of set up originally for conscientious objectors who had gone to prison. Instead of being a draft dodger, they just said they weren't going, and they went to prison. While they were in prison, they had very little to fall back on if their families fell apart or if they didn't have a family. You know, they're coming out of prison, and where are they going? What are they going to do? And I think at that point, Phil might have been in prison. Phil and Dan might have been in prison at that point for the Catonsville, maybe for the Catonsville action. I'm not exactly sure, which was burning draft cards. It wasn't plowshares. But anyhow, so they started this idea of community for people who had been to prison, who had, in one form or another, had stood up against war, and war making, and needed community to come out to. And so that's how Jonah House kind of originally started. In 1980, they did the first plowshare action, and they were just kind of like, so 1975, the Vietnam War ended, and there was all this talk that we were now in peacetime. We were not we were no longer in war. We're no longer in Vietnam. That was over. And there was no like threat of entering a new war. Yet behind closed doors, these people are making some of the most horrendous weapon systems. And they were, at this point, you know, doing the whole kind of Star Wars thing. And Reagan was talking about a limited nuclear war could be winnable. And I think it was the Physicians for Social Responsibility really put on an incredible campaign educating people about that this was a complete lie, and that this is what it would really look like if we were in any kind of nuclear exchange. And they laid out these horrendous, overwhelming statistics and visuals about what it would look like. And in the meantime, this small group of people were studying scripture together, and they were trying to figure out how to bring some kind of light to this darkness, to these things that were going on behind these closed doors, and meanwhile keeping all people kind of sedated in la-la land, thinking that we were now in peacetime and the economy was great and everything was wonderful and all this stuff. So they stumbled upon the Isaiah 2 passage. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not wage war against nation, nor shall they study war anymore. And this kind of followed another passage in Isaiah describing how all the nations would go up God's holy mountain, but they had to be disarmed. They would be disarmed first. And so they saw this literally as something that could be done, was to beat the swords of our time into plowshares and to begin the process of disarming our hearts, disarming our minds. They knew that they couldn't physically destroy the nuclear weapon system. no more than we could destroy the pipeline system or the fossil fuel system or any of these major systems that we have facing us. But we could symbolically and in real terms, we could begin that process. And that's what they saw when they read that passage was, wow, we can start this. We can start this disarmament process. We can beat the swords of our time into plowshares. And we can act as if we believe that the Spirit and God is with us in this, and that's where our strength will come from. So, they did the first one in 1980, and I don't know how many more plowshare actions there have been, well over 100 now in many different countries as well. Some of the stories that go with those plowshare actions are somewhat miraculous. And I can share a little bit about the second plowshare action that I did in conjunction with folks on the West Coast. We did it simultaneously. We went to the Newport News the Newport News shipyard where they were building the fast attack submarines. We learned about where they were located on this massive shipyard by taking a ferry tour, and the tour boat guide pointed out, oh, down there along this pier is where they're building so-and-so's submarines. And so we found out where that was. Now, this is the same shipyard that I had gone to 2 years prior. So we knew that after the first plowshare action I did there, they changed the security system on how you can actually get in. So you had the same badge. You had to have a badge, and the badge had a little dot on it, a different color, and each color was symbolized the security. We didn't know any of this. We just saw the workers going into 7-Eleven at their break. We looked at their badges. We had one person who was part of our group who was a great artist. He got in his mind what the badge looked like. He could draw it. He could draw the symbol, the icon of the shipyard. We looked at where the dot was. We went to the arcade. We got our little pictures taken. We pasted them on the "Hello, my name is" little white badge that you attach to your shirt at different meetings. And we got a cereal box that had the barcode, and we taped that on because we saw everybody had a barcode. And then in the back it said, your name, we put our name, and your occupation, we put disarmer. And then we had Isaiah's quote in the back, and we had our little blue dot, and we went into the shipyard. And we realized that our first encounter, they're supposed to take the badge from you, look at your badge, and take this very seriously. And we thought, how in the world are we going to get past this? And I looked over at the first person in our group, just gave this big smile and walked up to the guy in the booth and said, "Good morning. It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" And he just was like, "Yeah." And just motioned her through. And so we thought, oh, let's just follow suit. And so we did this. And we had four of us had planned on doing the action. The fifth person that was with us joined at the very last minute. And he was only coming to take pictures. And then he was planning on leaving. So the four of us got through, and it went to him. And they looked at his badge, which was exactly the same as our badge, and said, "Oh, you can't go in with a blue security sticker. You need to have an escort. Hang on, we'll get you an escort." And so when he realized that they were going to get an escort, he decided to take off and he left. It was like we were cloaked, and we walked right through and got down there and did everything that we had planned to do. We poured the blood, we put the banners up, we hammered on the lip of the launching tube for the Tomahawk cruise missile. We had a very symbolic number of hits that we were going to use so that we didn't just bang the shit out of it, but we had a certain number of times that we were going to actually hit that. And, you know, we just barely put a ding in it. So it wasn't really like meant to destroy it or to do any kind of maximum destruction. We weren't into that. And then we learned that our fifth friend had gotten out and we were in. Simultaneously now, two people on the West Coast, Steve Kelly and Susan Crane, approached the door to Lockheed Martin facility where they were going. You need to have one of those like little pass cards that you put in the door. They didn't have one of them, but they got to the door, and as soon as like they got there, the door magically opened up and they walked in. So like these are kinds of the kinds of things that you wonder, like, this must be really pleasing to the spirit for us to do this, for us to, the real hard work was going to come later on. And that is by the spirit, not by us. We just opened the door. That's all. We just opened the door and hoped that other people's minds and hearts would open as well. So now what do we have? We have ICAN. We have 50 countries now that have ratified a treaty saying that nuclear weapons are illegal. We haven't, our country hasn't done that, but who knows where that will lead to. We don't know. We just know that we've done this little opening of the door and bringing in, ushering in something new, and then see where it goes from there. So is that the action that is still relevant in our time right now? I'm not sure. I know there are people that are interested in learning about the plowshares. Would they be interested in continuing to do them? I don't know. And I think with Jonah House, we were stuck on that. That's all we did. That's how we identified. That's not all we did, but it's the majority of what we did. It's how we were identified. And when Phil died, a large part of Jonah House died too, because that was basically his vision, where the Catholic worker was a vision greater than Dorothy. And there was a question, when Dorothy died, would the Catholic worker die? And it has not, it's flourished, because the Catholic worker is bigger than Dorothy. But Jonah House really was not bigger than Phil. So I think that's one of the big differences.
So Michelle, I can imagine people saying when they hear this, you know, that this just doesn't seem very practical. like, you know, shutting down pipelines, getting rid of, you know, weapons of war, like we use fossil fuels, we need to protect ourselves. What's your response when people push on this piece of, well, that's just not practical to exist in the world this way?
Well, we certainly existed the human species, as well as the non-human species existed quite well without all of these things. And there are, I think one of the things that really moved me when I was in college was I went to this discussion. It was mandatory, actually. And it was about Ladakh, the Ladakhians. And these were a group of people who lived somewhere around the Himalayas. They had not been associated with the Western world, or actually anything outside of the world, outside of their little world, until somehow or another the Westerners stumbled upon them and began to study them. Prior to that, they lived, their whole society was sustainable. And they had no like policing system. They lived in what I think would be comparable to like these different kind of like autonomous zones that are popping up around the world. I experienced a little bit of that when I visited Rojava in the Syria boundaries, in the boundaries of Syria, how a civil society could develop without what we have just taken as absolutely necessary, the things that we have in the Western world. We see these things as necessary. They're not necessary. And I don't know if we'll ever really be able to get out from under it. But I feel like we will be forced to get out from under it. Because everything now is fighting back for its life. And we as human beings, we're not the center of the world. And life will go on without us here, and without our things, and without our gadgets, and without all of these things that we have now said is absolutely necessary, without a structural society that we say is absolutely necessary. Life is fighting hard. And I think that at this point, what I feel like it's most important is to somehow work in harmony with that, to bring out that energy. Instead of thinking that like I can stop something by force, even if it's symbolic force, that I can stop something like one of these industries, one of these very, very destructive industries. Alone? No, I can't. But I'm trying to learn how to understand the language of the rest of life that is going on around us and in us, and how to raise up that energy so that that life can carry on. If I'm not here, it's okay. If I'm here, then it's great too. I mean, like, I don't want to die or anything like that. I'm good, and we're all going to die at some point. But I'm not like saying I should die so others can live. I'm saying that I need to find out how to resonate with life. And that is something that I'm learning a lot more from my native friends they understand the language. I have to trust that they understand the language. They've lived in harmony with nature without all of these things for a long, long time, and they can do it again. And they're trying to teach people how to do it, as teach people who did not grow up with that as well. So yeah, that's kind of, I don't know. I don't really have a big argument for people like, yeah, you drove your car. Didn't you drive your car to turn off the oil? I don't want to get into those kinds of arguments. That's not the important thing right now. Right now is trying to figure out the best way to help life for the common good, and not for any one particular agenda or any one particular group or any one particular species, but for the common good. Where is the best place to be to help life heal and go on for the common good? A lot of our asylum seekers have a lot of this knowledge. So, like, you know, we're not doing, we're it's a very mutual thing here, recognizing that they have lived and know things. This one guy from Nigeria, he would tell us that his father, his mom was a Catholic, his father was Muslim, but he was also the indigenous spiritual leader of their village. And he would tell us stories about the things they learned from the forest, living in the, or like surrounded by the forest, the things they learned from living off the land, and the things that they learned in their relationship with Creator, with God, through that relationship that they had with the land. I learned so much from this one guy than It's just incredible. I don't know. Like, I feel like they have so much that they can that they bring here and teach us as well as we have to offer them. So maybe in a way that's what mutual aid is. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what this mutual aid thing is, because I do think that that is the way, one of the ways that we're going to go. This idea that we're going to be, that we should continue on as part of the system and make our houses look like, an extension of the system, is not working. And it's never felt right, and it doesn't feel right now. I'm not exactly sure what mutual aid is. I was very grateful to read that book. I was sorry that I didn't finish the discussion, but it's something that I'm still like trying to learn and struggle with.
You're referring to our online Catholic worker book club there,
Yes, I
right?
am. Yes, I am. That was a good book, by the way.
Yeah. I think you hinted on in there your some of your time in Kurdistan and your work with Solidarity with the folks there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen and what's happening and the work you've done around that?
Sure. I mean, first I'll start with saying that I joined CPT, Christian Peacemaker Teams, after my second plowshare action. And I saw a number of really good people, like Anne Montgomery was one person who I really respected a lot, who went into CPT. And I always wondered why, and she would talk to us about it and everything, because it was my support network, part of my support network, Second Plowshare Action that I was part of. And she spoke about, like, if we were going to say no to weapons and war, what are we saying yes to? And that was a question that became part of my thinking as well. What are we saying yes to? How do we live out nonviolence in the midst of a war zone? And so, yeah, so I joined CPT, and originally I went to the Iraq team. We were in Baghdad at that point. And when I joined the team, I did a couple of delegations. So I went there on my own. I mean, not on my own, but I went there as not part of the team, but as part of a delegation, with the idea that I would join a team at some point, do the training and all of that. Which was pretty extensive, but it took a little while before I got to that point. I finally did, and the year, the time that I joined the Iraq team was my first stint on team was when my teammates were kidnapped. So we had four teammates that were kidnapped in Baghdad and had been missing for 4 months. Yeah, they finally, three of them made it out. One was killed. And during that time, the violence had escalated to a point where it was out of control. And even the people that we were working with there, because our work was to be with not to be with people who are also working with human rights and non and violence reduction, that were local to that were indigenous to that area, and we were supposed to help raise their voice. Basically, it wasn't like us doing this great savior work, because we couldn't, obviously we couldn't do that. But and so they were saying, it's not safe for us to have you here anymore. It's not safe for us. Not for the CPTers, but for them, to have us there. So once the kidnapping was resolved, then our team was asked to move to Kurdistan. Well, it was asked to move out of Baghdad. They suggested going to Kurdistan, thinking that maybe 6, 7 months the violence would slow up. We would be able to come back. The team would be able to come back. That didn't happen. While the team was in Kurdistan, we began to learn about the Kurds. I had never even heard of the Kurdish people before. So they wanted us to stay there and work with them. And And so we did. We made that decision that we were not going to go back to Baghdad. We really couldn't go back to Baghdad anyhow, but we pretty much decided to give it up and put some see what kind of roots we could put down in the Kurdish north, and then began a long, long lesson of the Kurdish plight in the Middle East, who they were, what had happened to them, where they are in the world now, how they identify or don't identify. It's a very, very complicated, complex situation. And the longer I stayed, the stupider I felt. Because you kind of like go in to these things. Like, I remember the first time I went to Baghdad with the delegation, I came back thinking I could talk to people after 10 days. I could talk to people about like all the problems of Iraq and in Iraq and why the US is only making things worse. Well, the US did make things worse, but I really did not know anything about the history of Iraq. Their history goes back and back and back and back. The Kurds goes back even further. You feel really stupid after a while, how little you know about history. So anyhow, yeah, we started working with the villagers. I really identified with the villagers, not the people in the cities, but the people that lived up in the villages. And they were constantly under attack by Turkey, who considered them all terrorists only because they didn't like them. Because I think the Kurds were part of taking down the Ottoman Empire, and this was a very big slap in the face to the Turkish people, who saw themselves as strong military fighters, taken down by to have their empire taken down like that. Anyhow, yeah, so I worked we worked a lot with the villagers, and in the process I learned, and they were all in Iraq. So, you know, there's Kurds in four different countries. At this point, they're all over the place now, but they were, when they were taken over in 1918, they had one Kurdistan for a very short time, and then they were a very bad deal by the Brits and the French. They were split up into, Kurdistan was taken away, and they were split up into four countries: Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. And I probably knew the least about the Syrian Kurds, a little bit more, obviously, about the Iraqi Kurds because we were living there. Some about the Turkish Kurds, because that's a lot of where the conflict was coming from, was Turkey, and then some with Iran. And Rojava was developing. I didn't know what Rojava was until after it developed. And that was an incredible learning experience. So I was not part of the team any longer. I had done 6 years with CPT, and that was enough for me. But I had made friends there, and I had started to go back to the Kurdish North in Iraq on my own, and stay with these friends. And in that process, I learned about what was happening in Rojava and the development of Kobani, which was the big kind of like Rojava became a kind of an autonomous zone. It was not its own nation state. Didn't want to be its own nation state. It was self civil society that was protected with these people's protection units. There was not their military. It was, you know, their people protection units. And I didn't really know about the civil society part of it. You only hear, you know, like when you hear just like the news part, you always hear about the fighters. That's the most dramatic part, right? Everybody wants to talk about the fighters. But there's this whole civil society that was developing. And I started to learn about that while I was living in Iraqi Kurdistan. And we had developed a sister city. Duluth and Rania have developed a sister city. And so I was staying in Rania. It was in the Iraqi Kurdish area. And there were a lot of refugees from the Rojava area that were had come to Rania. And when they ran, when the People's Protection Unit ran ISIS out of this area, it was quite incredible to see this flag go down and the Kurdish flag go up, and everybody is in tears. I'm in tears. I don't even know, you know, these people, but like, it's just like, there's a sense of like, they had driven out this evil, and you were there. Like, you were there, and you were, this energy was all entering into you. Anyhow, they started talking about like these people, they wanted to go home. The refugees that were there, they wanted to go back. And so they did, and they described what it was like. And they said that if there wasn't some help from the international community to help them rebuild, that ISIS would just be able to come in and take over again. Folks in Rania started talking about like building a school. And I thought, well, Duluth, where your sister city, maybe we can build a library. So I went back to Duluth and said, hey, let's build a library. So I raised $10,000, and we had a big Kurdish dinner. We did all kinds of things here and raised $10,000, and went back to Rania. And after many, many attempts of trying to get me across the border into Syria and then into Rojava, it was taking a long time. It looked like it wasn't going to happen. I'm walking around with $10,000 in cash in my pocket, because you can't exactly take a cashier's check with you to Rojava and expect to be able to cash it. So I got $10,000, and I got 3 books that were donated from the people in Duluth to go into the new library. So I'm carrying this around. And they finally decided to let me go into Rojava or into Syria, but I couldn't take any of my Kurdish friends with me. Well, I don't know how to speak. I could speak Sirani Kurdish a little, but I didn't know Kurmanji, which is their language over there. And so I was like, and they gave me a cell phone, which I still don't know how to use the cell phone. And they said, you see that boat? You get on that boat. When you get on the other side, you see that flag that's coming off that building? I said, yeah. They said, well, when you get over to that other side, you ask for Mr. Aris. I said, okay. So then here's your cell phone, my $10,000 and my 3 books in my little duffel bag. And I got on the boat and I went over and asked for Mr. Aris. And then through a series of very, very also miraculous events, I met up with a woman, a Kurdish woman, a Yazidi woman from Washington, D.C., who spoke English. And we traveled together to Kobani. When she went and did her thing and I went and did my thing. My thing was to deliver the $10,000 and the 3 books to somebody in civil society. And that's what I did. But in the meantime, I didn't really know much about this civil society. So in my very short time there, I got a very good lesson of what Rojava was about. And my intention was to go back for like 3 months, like the following year. And then it never worked out for me to go back for many different reasons. And finally, somebody here said to me, one of my native elder friends said, did you ever think that maybe we need you here, that you're just not meant to go there? And I said, well, I'm going there because I need to learn what they know, because I think a lot of it can apply to what how we might be able to live. And he was like, well, it doesn't seem like it's meant to be. So maybe we just need you here more. And that began the entry into the valve turning action. So from there, that was the end of my Rojava experience. But I still stayed in touch with folks there. I haven't in a while now, but for many years I did.
And theirs is kind of like, I don't know if they use these words, like quasi-anarchist, like eco-feminist kind of setup, right? That's why a lot of people were inspired by them.
Yeah, I don't think they use those terms exactly. But okay, so in the Middle East, everything became a monoculture when it was taken over by Islam, by mostly by Islam. It became a monoculture, mono religion, mono language, Arabic. Women were not even visible, were not visible. So it was male dominated. And that part of the world was not like that in its early days. And there's in Damascus, there's a monastery there. I can't remember the name of it, but that's another place I really wanted to go visit. And I saw a video about it, and this priest was describing this area in Damascus, that general area. And he said this was the place where the great traditions would all come through here. This was like the trade route, the migration route. So some of the great civilizations passed through here, and the great religions passed through here. So Christians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Muslims, and they would come through this one particular monastery, and they lived together and interacted together for their time, and they shared the best of them. And I remember this guy saying, "There's collective memory here. There's a collective memory here, and we can't lose it, because that's what the monoculture tried to do, was erase it." And what he saw was places like Rojava trying to reignite that collective memory of what it meant for the great civilizations to bring the best of themselves through and teach each other and move on, not try to take it over or occupy it or oppress it or make it their own agenda, but they shared this. It's like incredible collective memory. And when he said that about Rojava, that's what they're trying to do. So they were multilingual, multicultural. This was very big. It still is big over there. Multicultural, multilingual. I can't say that it's not a gender. It is still very male and but female and male equality. But there's no other recognition of any other identity. It's male or female. They can't make a decision unless it's a equal, unless those decisions are made by equal number of women and equal number of men. So it was not going to be its own nation. It would not have a nation state status. It would be self-governing from the bottom up. The most power would be on the bottom, and the representatives that, as it went up the line, or however you want to look at it, they became recognized more and more as the servants of the people, not the other way around. The people were not the servant that were not the servants for these people on the top, but it was this they were the servants for the people on the bottom. The people on the bottom held the power. It would be self-protected. It would not rely on a military, and it would be governed like a yeah. In the commune was the smallest segment. And then it grew from there to what they called oh, I forgot the name of it now. But there were three different areas. Yeah, I forgot the name of how they named it, but they got bigger. But again, the neighborhood and the commune were the where was where the most power was. Yeah. So, and they had different like education, agriculture, clothing, like your kind of like basic needs were the that was like that was where emphasis was put on. Like, so you would find yourself in whatever one of these categories where you felt drawn to. If you were like into the agriculture, you would spearhead that work, or you'd be part of that work. If you were education, you'd be part of that work. Health, that was another thing, healthcare. So they had the different like basic human needs covered, and you fit into one of those things. And it was all socialist, I guess you might say. It wasn't for profit. There was no profit making. It was not capitalism. It was very anti-capitalist. Would you say it was anarchist? I'm not exactly sure, because there were certain rules and regulations that people followed, but really, in the true sense of the word of anarchism, you're internally, you abide by those sets of norms and reality and rules that you have to follow in any society, basically, but you're not being like forced to by a police state. You're not being ruled over. But you, it's actually it takes a lot more discipline to be an anarchist than it does to obey a bunch of rules that a nation state puts on you for its own purposes. Yeah.
That's so very interesting, Michelle. I feel like you have so many different aspects that are just fascinating of these projects and parts of your life you've been involved in. We're definitely very grateful that you spent the time to share them with us. As we wrap up, are there any sort of thoughts you'd have, advice you'd give to people who are looking to join the Catholic Worker, or people who are trying to discern like where they fit within the movement?
Yes. I would say that it's really good to be a part of, to get to know the Catholic Worker through the bigger kind of the bigger movement, and not kind of get absorbed into one particular house and see that as that house is the Catholic Worker. The Catholic Worker is much bigger than the house. It's than any house itself. So for people to be able to hear that, and then given the opportunity to explore that, and to be given the opportunity to explore that without judgment by the older people who kind of think that the way they've been doing it forever is the only way in the right way. And there's a lot that the people who have done this for many, many, many years, that have dedicated their, you know, basically their whole life, adult life, to the Catholic Worker, there's a lot to learn from them. I'm saying that it's important to see the kind of bigger, the whole bigger picture. To recognize that there's a lot of wisdom in the elders, and for the elders to recognize that there's a lot of vision in the younger generation. And with the wisdom and the vision, you have a chance of like really being part of something for the common good. Again, it really comes back down to the common good. Yeah, not your one particular house, but for the common good. And there's a lot. I think that there is a lot of very deep, wise, and faith just it packed in the Catholic Worker. It's definitely it's a viable and a necessary movement, I think. We just got to find our way. In this new century, we things are changing, and things always change. That's life. Things will change. How are we going to change with it? What are we going to hold on to that is our solid rock? What do we let go of that is our own identity or our own agenda? Like, those are the things that we've got to be able to discern and just and do it together with from all of these different angles. And we have a place. We definitely have a place in the world. I really appreciate you all doing this because it gives an opportunity for us to hear from each other our different little perspectives and help us find our way.
Well, we appreciate you doing this and sharing a bit of your wisdom and knowledge and experience with us.
Yeah.
So a huge thanks to Michelle for meeting with us and sharing some of her stories. Whenever I hear Michelle's stories, I'm always reminded just how much room the spirit has to work when we're simply open to it. I think that came through again and again of this miraculous provision of the spirit that we only see if we put ourselves in those situations.
Yeah, she had a lot of experiences there. Like, we could have taken any one of those segments and just looked at that, and it could have been a whole episode. Or we could have, or Michelle could have lived any single one of those, and it probably would have been a Catholic worker life well lived. But, you know, she's done so much and seen so many things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. She definitely has this openness to change and this boldness to simply go for it at times.
I really appreciate that openness to change. And I think it's very wise of her when she speaks about our need to be open to learning from the past for us young folks, but also the older generations too, being open to hear the spirit in the younger one. And it sounds like it was born out in many ways of her own experiences in Duluth and seeing that community's difficulties, and in Jonah House and the elders there. It's something that comes up again and again within the movement, it seems like, at various houses.
How to sort of stay true to these values and principles, and at the same time, how does the movement become more expansive and continue to grow and adapt to the current space that we are in?
That was something I really admired too, was they're growing the movement, even if not within that name, you know, the Christ rooms in different people's houses. That's ultimately like my dream. Like, I want to spread the word of the Catholic worker, and I want there to be more Catholic workers. But if, you know, each one of us could get six people to do Catholic worker stuff who wouldn't otherwise be, even if they're not saying, oh yes, I'm a Catholic worker, that would just be amazing. And there they are. They've been able to do that.
So if you're listening and you want to fulfill Theo's dreams, go ahead and work on setting up your own hospitality network and let us know. We can have you on the podcast later. Well, this wraps up another episode of Coffee with Catholic Workers. If you want to reach out to us, give us any comments, any suggestions, clarification of thought, you can email us at coffeewithcatholicworkers@gmail.com. We want to thank Chris from Bloomington Catholic Worker with help editing, David Hayes for our music, and Becky McIntyre for our graphic.
Thanks for joining us again for some clarification of thought. We hope today's conversation and discussion have been enlightening, and maybe even that you're encouraged to go out and help build a world where it's easier to be good.